So, welcome. Thank you for being here. So I declare I have nothing to declare. No relationships to disclose. So I'll be talking about political violence and health among Palestinian women, in particular looking at the potential protective effects of internal and external coping strategies. So this map depicts major episodes of political violence from 1946 to 2010. Political violence is a general term that encompasses things like wars, violent conflicts, state violence. It also includes things like ongoing military occupations and internal strife. So defined this way, there's been over 300 episodes of political violence since 1946. So it's a significant problem both worldwide and domestically. We know worldwide that there's 12 million refugees and between 22 and 25 million internally displaced people. The majority of these are fleeing political violence of one kind or another. So with that context, this study takes place in the West Bank. It's a part of an ongoing research collaboration between myself and the Palestinian Medical Relief Society, which is one of the oldest and largest healthcare NGOs in Palestine. They really use health as a way to talk about social justice and really tying in issues of community development, social justice, and health. They run a variety of different programs, including mobile clinics, ambulances, mental health programs, children's programs, all kinds of different programs. So to give you some geographic context, this is a map that shows the West Bank. So the West Bank is an area of about 55,000 square kilometers, which is about the size of Delaware. It's been under Israeli military occupation since 1967. In 2007, when the study began, the UN estimated that 38% of the West Bank is taken up by Israeli infrastructure. So this map, the red line depicts the path of the wall at that time, which has changed and changed back. It's a very contentious issue, the wall. So the red line depicts the map or the path of the wall at this time. The red dots are the checkpoints that were in the West Bank at this time. So in 2007, the United Nations does regular ongoing documentation of barriers to access within the West Bank. So in 2007, they found 539 barriers within the West Bank. And again, keep in mind that's about the size of Delaware. So those barriers included 56 concrete roadblocks, 90 gates. So this, for instance, is a gate that's separating Palestinian land from other Palestinian land. And then up on the hill, you see an Israeli settlement built in the West Bank. And it also includes 74 staffed checkpoints. So there's also things called flying checkpoints, which means that the checkpoint moves from place to place, but the staff checkpoint is the standing stationary checkpoint. So the sample for this study, we sampled adult women. The mean age is about 33. We collected 122 surveys, and we did 5 focus groups. I'll just be talking about the quantitative data here, but the focus groups asked similar questions about political violence, health, and resilience within the West Bank. Participants were drawn from PMRS populations as well as from populations from the Palestinian Ministry of Health. So they're drawn from non-clinical client populations, which means this study primarily focuses on mental health, but they're not drawn from mental health clinics. They're drawn from, for example, eye care clinics, clinics, rehabilitation programs, and clinics for children. And then some sample was also drawn from the university. So this survey consisted of 8 scales and about 150 questions. Translation was done by professional translators in the West Bank, and then the translation was verified by staff members from the Palestinian Medical Relief Society. The development of the survey took about a year. It included lots of consultation with experts in the fields of trauma, mental health, resilience, as well as experts in the area of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict to kind of think about, you know, what are factors that we would need to consider when we're looking at political violence in that area. And survey development also included a focus group that was done with Palestinians who were temporarily living in the United States. So they gave feedback about the survey, both in terms of the practical implications of taking the survey, in terms of its length and the translation, as well as talking about any ethical or emotional issues related to the survey. Okay, so the survey includes exposure to occupation-related stressors, and from that I made two indices, one that represented lifetime experiences of exposure to political violence and one that measured political violence in the last month. The lifetime exposure included 12 items. The alpha for that scale was 0.75. The index for the past month political violence included 7 items, and that alpha was 0.8. I also measured health, so it's great that we had such a good overview of general health status, because that was one of my outcomes, was general health perception, as well as a composite index of mental health. Both of those were from the SF-12, which is an abbreviated version of the SF-36, a widely used scale that's used all over the world to measure health. I used a brief PTSD assessment and the Kessler 10, which is a measure of distress. For coping, I looked at proactive coping, and I also looked at the kinds of supports that people relied on. So I looked at both their reliance on themselves, as well as their reliance on political, family, and religious support. And then I also had a one-item measure of political civic engagement. I was interested in if that would be a protective factor for people. So that question was, I take part in activities to better the life of my people. That was a measure of political and civic engagement. So to make the coping scale, I did an exploratory factor analysis and created the four different measures there, which is self-reliance, political reliance, family reliance, and religious reliance. To test protective effects, I did tests of interactions within regression equations, and then I plotted the significant results. So I had two hypotheses. The first was that reports of political violence exposure would be related to reports of both poor physical health as well as poor mental health. We know from numerous other studies, many in the Palestinian areas, that exposure to political violence negatively impacts mental health. The WHO estimates around the world that exposure to political violence causes some sort of mental health consequence in about one-third to one-half of the population that's exposed. But there's also some recent evidence talking about the relationships between political violence and physical health. In part, those can be explained perhaps by theories of chronic stress that talk about how when you experience chronic stress and trauma, it wears your body down and results in an increased progression of disease. So besides looking at the direct effects of political violence on health, I also was looking at how coping might function as moderators of the effects of political violence to either buffer or weaken its effects on physical and mental health outcomes. So first I'll just present an overview of the findings of experiences of political violence within our sample. This is a picture that I took at a checkpoint of a soldier, an Israeli soldier, who's not allowing passage through to these boys' land. So military force, so this is the percent of respondents who said yes to the lifetime question of if they'd ever been detained or arrested. So about 13% of our sample had been detained or arrested. About 8% reported they were beaten by Israeli forces at some point in their life. 19% reported they'd been strip searched by Israeli forces. And just over 1 out of 4 had been threatened by Israeli forces. Second, related to material loss. 15% reported that their home or business had been demolished by Israeli forces. Almost 30% reported that their family had been separated from their land due to the occupation. And that entails not only a material loss, obviously a loss of the ability to make money or to harvest food, but also a loss of tradition and culture and history. 24% said that their ability to access health care had suffered as a result of the wall, checkpoints, or borders. And more than half said that their family had lost income directly because of the occupation. The indices also looked at infrastructure for surveillance, which is a major part of political violence. So in terms of seeing the wall, half of our sample had seen the wall 4 or more times in the past month. with 32% reporting that the wall is always present, which could mean, for instance, that it's right outside their door or that it's right outside their town and they constantly see it. In terms of the Army being in their town, 18% said that the Army was in their town 10 or more times in the past month, or that maybe the Army was always present in their town. And 1 in 4 reported that the Army was in their town 4 or more times in the past month. And then finally, in terms of passing through checkpoints, 70% of the sample said that they passed through a checkpoint at least 1 time in the past month, with 1/3 of the sample responding that 4 or more times they had had to pass through checkpoints in the last month. And separation from family. So 20% had had a detention or arrest happen to a family member, so 1 in 5 people reported that a family member had been detained or arrested by Israeli forces. And 15% reported that they'd been separated from their family due to the wall, checkpoints, or borders, which meant that they couldn't visit their family, they couldn't go and take care of the family business, those sorts of things. So I found a significant relationship between political violence and mental health. Both past 30-day and lifetime measures of political violence were positively correlated with PTSD symptoms at around 0.3. Neither measure of political violence was related to distress nor to general health perception and mental health as assessed with SF-12. They weren't directly related, but there were some significant moderation findings, which I'll report now. So for PTSD symptoms and distress, there were no significant interactions. So I found no moderation between any of our coping scales and PTSD or distress. However, for general health, I did find some significant things that ended up being risk factors, which was a surprise to me, and I'll talk about that a little bit. So proactive coping, political civic engagement, self-reliance, and self-reliance all emerged as significant risk factors, which meant that as political violence rose, those who relied heavily on these kinds of coping demonstrated worse general health perception. And I'm going to talk a little bit about some reasons why that might be. One thing that I think is interesting is that these all are sort of more internalized and individualized coping patterns. So one thing that I'm considering is that perhaps people who are more, who have a tendency to sort of depend on themselves and isolate themselves, when political violence gets worse and there's less and less that they can do to actually improve the situation by their own actions, then it sort of reinforces negative mental health. So it sort of increases self-blame and might, in that way, negatively affect mental health. There was a significant protective factor, and that was religious support. So as political violence rose, those who relied heavily on religious support demonstrated better general health perception and better general mental health. Now, this is in line with a lot of other findings that are indicating that religion really acts as a positive force in people's lives, particularly within the context of political violence. But I was interested, our measure of religious support included both sort of religiosity, so it included the item, you know, I pray or I believe what happened was fate, and that it also included it also included questions related to reliance on religious institutions. So it included, I seek information and advice from religious institutions, and I participate in religious activities. So I did some post hoc analyses to look at, you know, what is the aspect of religion that's protective in this question. And it was interesting because what I found was that the protective effect of reliance on religion was not due to religiosity, which is what a lot of studies attribute the protective factor within religion to, but it was to the protective effect was only found in the sort of active community aspects of religion. So only those areas which were the seeking information and advice and participating in religious activities were protective. And that was interesting because I also found that reliance on political organizations approached significance. I didn't report the findings here because it only approached significance at 0.9, but this idea of sort of institutions and the role of institutions within people's lives seemed to be a very important aspect of protection within the question of political violence and health. This is just one of the figures. So you can see that sort of at low experiences of political violence, those who actively participate in religion, it doesn't seem to be protective, but as political violence rises, the act of religion becomes important and people have better general health perception as political violence rises if they highly rely on religious institutions. So this just sort of depicts how I'm thinking about some of the results. So it seems like as political violence increases, self-reliance emerges as a risk factor, whereas reliance on institutions is somewhat protective, which has some interesting implications, I think. So one question that remains is, could it be that in periods of relative calm, internalized coping is useful and protective? But as political violence increases, it's more protective to not rely on self, but to draw on community. And this really has been what other people have found in the literature, especially about political violence, that the more that it's understood as a communal problem that targets a group of people and that therefore it takes a community to respond to it, that that is actually a healthier way of people responding to political violence, and that protects their mental health and in fact aids in recovery. So there's some limitations, an extremely small sample size, so an increased risk of type 2 errors. There might have been a lot of results that I just missed because the sample was so small. It was cross-sectional and convenient sample. And I didn't consider the quality of the coping resource, so I just asked them, you know, do you rely on these sources? But I didn't ask, for instance, how strong is your family, how strong is your religious organization? So perceptions of the quality of the resource that they're coping on could have been a very important factor within their mental health and general health sort of configuration. So what are the implications? Well, first, I think it's important to note that this study demonstrates how important it is to assess and treat for aspects of political violence that are often overlooked. So it's sometimes easier to think about political violence in terms of the grandiose. You know, have you seen someone be shot in front of you? Have you been shot? But as you saw from my measures, a lot of them are sort of what I think of as more of the quotidian stressors of political violence, so the everyday things that can really wear on people. And those are really important to look at, especially in situations of ongoing conflict and ongoing oppression. It also shows that research advocacy and intervention on political violence should attend to both physical health and mental health. And interestingly, too, recent studies are finding that there is this real connection, that physical health could be potentially a mediator within the relationship between political violence and mental health. So looking at those complex relationships as we move forward is going to be important. Of course, looking at factors that build resilience is essential. I mean, we know that people actively respond to the environment around them. They're not just sort of blank recipients of the violence, but they actively work to recover for themselves and for their communities. And so support from institutions and organized activities may be a really critical protective factor, and those need to be attended to within both ongoing situations of political violence and during times of recovery. The interesting thing is that those institutions are often specifically attacked within political violence. So religious institutions, political organizations are often the recipients of violence and oppression. So thinking in terms of a multi-level intervention when we're looking at political violence is core to help within situations of political violence. I have a whole bunch of people that I want to thank. This has been a long project, and I'm excited to share the findings with all of you. It also, there's a paper that I have coming out in the most recent issue of the American Journal of Orthopsychiatry that highlights these findings. So thank you all.